Welcome to Scooter's Cast, Regulatory Taking and Contiguous Parcels Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On March 20th, 2017, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Murr v. Wisconsin. In 1960 and 1963, the Murrs purchased two adjacent lots, lots F and E, each over an acre in size, in St. Croix County, Wisconsin. In 1994 and 1995, the parents transferred the parcels to their children. In 1995, the two lots were merged pursuant to St. Croix County's Code of Ordinances. 7 years later, the Murrs wanted to sell Lot E but not Lot F, but they were denied permission to do so by the St. Croix County Board of Adjustment. The Murrs sued the state and county, claiming that the ordinance in question resulted in an uncompensated taking of their property and deprived them of all, or practically all, of the use of Lot E, because the lot cannot be sold or developed as a separate lot. The Circuit Court granted summary judgment to the state and county. The Court of Appeals of Wisconsin affirmed, and the Wisconsin Supreme Court denied further review. The question before the Supreme Court is whether, in a regulatory taking case, the parcel as a whole concept, as described in Penn Central Transportation Company v. City of New York, establishes a rule that two legally distinct but commonly owned contiguous parcels must be combined for takings analysis purposes. To discuss the case, we have James S. Burling, who is Director of Litigation, Pacific Legal Foundation. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Burling.
This is probably one of the most important property right cases for several years at the Supreme Court. It deals with the intersection of the ownership of adjacent lots and government regulation. Now, many people own adjacent lots. A farmer may acquire a neighboring farm with the hope that his children can live next door. Or a person, as happened here, might fall in love with a vacation home and buy an empty lot next door. But what happens when new zoning laws declare those lots to be too small and substandard? If the government denies the use of one parcel, can it avoid any takings liability simply because the owner happens to own the next door property? And that's the question that was argued today in Murr versus State of Wisconsin. Here, the Murrs own two adjacent lots on the St. Croix River. Their parents purchased one lot in the 1960s, and they built a small 950-square-foot cabin on it, and they loved it. So 3 years later, 1963, they bought a second lot. Both lots are an acre and a quarter, more or less, and things went swimmingly well for many, many years. Now, in around 76, new regulations are passed, making the lots nonconforming because after setbacks for waterfront and slopes, et cetera, were added in, each lot had less than an acre of buildable area. The two lots together had 0.98 acres of buildable area. Now, if different individuals own the lots, each person would be able to separately or sell these two lots under a grandfathered clause. That is, we'll call one lot F, where the cabin is, and one lot E, which is the investment lot. And there was an exception to these new regulations from the 1970s, and that is for an individual who owned the lots, who was too small to develop on. They're allowed to develop the property because undoubtedly the state and the county realized that it would be too harsh and potentially a takings if use were disallowed on one lot. But there is an exception to the grandfather clause, and the exception is for somebody who owns the next-door property. The children want to sell the unoccupied property, and they could sell it, according to the appraisal, for about $410,000. They want to sell it in order to raise money to make badly needed repairs on the cabin, but they cannot. And they think that they have been taken of their interest to sell this property. But the county and the state and the federal government, in various and varying arguments, argued that no, there is, you should not look simply at the individual lot by itself, that you have to join these three lots together. And let me be clear, the arguments of the state and the county and the federal government were very different in some respects. We'll get into that in a bit. But the bottom line from the Murr's position is that these lots are separate. They had certainly initially, when they were purchased in the 1960s, thought they were separate. Now, the problem is that the county has decided these are, and the lower court below decided these were effectively merged by the regulations, and that the children can only think of these lots and only be treated by the government as if they were a unified single lot although they're still deeded separately, and for many years they were taxed separately until this litigation began. And they're arguing that we don't really care if we could build on the two lots together. We want to be able to sell the investment lot. So the state points out that, you know, if you were able to sell the two lots separately, it might be worth $700,000+. And if you sell them and if you have to look at them together, you only lose 9% of the total value. But the children, the Mert children, said that doesn't help us. The Mert children acquired these two lots in 1995, and they acquired them under single unified ownership, whereas the parents bought one as their plumbing company and one as their personal investment, essentially the same thing, but they were technically legally separate. And so today the children are saying we still want to consider them separate, although there was unified ownership from 1995, because telling us that we can merge the lots and then build a big home on them doesn't do us any good. We want to stay on the property. We want to improve the cabin, but we can't do that. So the question before the court is, in a claim of a taking, what is the relevant parcel? The Penn Central decision from a number of years ago, the court said that you should begin by figuring out what the property interest at stake is. What is the relevant parcel? Is it everything somebody owns? In the Penn Central case, that was dealing with a railroad terminal in New York City that wanted to build above the terminal but was not allowed to. The court rejected the idea that you should consider the other parcels that the railroad owned in the vicinity, including a hotel next door. They said, no, no, you're going to look at the railroad parcel, but you cannot separate out the air rights from the terminal itself. Those need to be considered together. So it really did not answer the question in a situation like this where somebody owns two adjacent lots. So we had oral argument on this case today, and the argument was a very, as often the case, a lively bench. We made the argument that you should start with the presumption that when you have a separately deeded and plotted lot, the presumption is that these are separate lots and they should not be joined together. The presumption can be overcome sometimes. For example, if you could clearly show, and this is not, we didn't argue it this way, but this is an example, if you could clearly show that the lots are really so small that they would be a nuisance to develop them together, too small for a septic system, for example, then it may be that you don't have a property right, sort of a nuisance, to use these properties separately. That may be a time when a court might look at the two parcels together, or you may have a situation, as we argue today, where one lot could be a parking lot and the other lot could be a hotel, with a hotel being served by the parking lot. In a case like that, it may be quite appropriate that the lots be merged together. But here, the argument is that the parcels are separate. So there were a lot of questions from the bench. I would consider it a very hot bench. Kennedy began by asking questions on valuation of what if the two lots together were each worth $100,000. I mean, if separately were $100,000, but together were much more, they were $500,000. And I think the answer is, in this particular case, if the MERS wanted to develop and sell only one lot, they were not interested in the assembly value, then you look at the value of the independent lot that they are trying to sell. You had some questions dealing with, well, the fact is when they acquired these properties in 1995 from their parents, when they were joined together, they were on notice of the regulation, right? And the answer is, well, notice is not the be-all and end-all of these questions. In the Palo Zolo case, the Supreme Court, that was one that I argued 15 years ago, and Justice Kennedy said, just because you acquire properties subject to regulation doesn't mean you cannot sell, we cannot argue that there's been a taking. The transfer of property from one owner to the next doesn't change the fundamental nature of the property right. You cannot alter property rights simply through sale. But on the other hand, some members of the court, Kagan, for example, was saying, well, it doesn't really matter because Palo Zolo said you could bring a taking claim, but it doesn't mean that that's all it means. You can still bring a taking claim, but you're going to win. One of the fundamental arguments that we, representing the MERS, were trying to impress the court with, that a lot of the questions and tests proffered by the state and St. Croix and the federal government go really to the question of whether or not there's been a taking. You look at investment factor expectations, but that's in the context of whether or not there's a taking. You look at the economic impact in the context of determining under Penn Central whether there's been a taking. But our argument essentially comes down to the fact that before you enter into this analysis of whether or not there's a taking, you have to define what the property is. Is it one lot that you're arguing that's been taken or two lots? And our argument essentially comes down to the fact that the more, it should not be a rule that the more you own, the more government can take. The more you own, the government simply can't come in and steal your property saying, hey, you own more than one lot. It's quite clear in this case, if an other individual owned this investment lot, an individual that could have been husband and wife owning lots next to each other, it's quite clear that if you own simply one lot, you could develop or sell this property, but because the MERS own the adjacent lot, you cannot. And we think that's fundamentally unfair. So the other side, also, the argument was split three ways for this position, or the side of the county arguing for affirmance. First of all, you had the state of Wisconsin, argued by Misha, who will be talking and speaking with us next. And Misha probably can describe his argument more accurately than I can, but the state of Wisconsin has an argument that, you know, it's not a, let me put it this way. It begins by saying that the decision from the Court of Appeals below, nobody really agrees with completely, because the decision of the Court of Appeals below is that there's a bright line test that whenever you have two adjacent properties, they have to be considered together. And the state certainly has not been arguing that case. The state is arguing what I call for a more nuanced position than that, arguing that you really have to, you know, look at a number of different things in determining whether or not the property has been taken. And the state of Wisconsin's argument is, I mean, they're all wrong from my standpoint, of course. I'm saying that somewhat tongue-in-cheek because we argued for the MERS. But the state of Wisconsin's argument is probably the less radical of the arguments, but still I think it's one that should not, hopefully not prevail. The county, represented by Richard Lazarus, was arguing for a standard that I think would completely mix up the question of what a taking is with the question of what the underlying property is. And finally, the federal government was arguing for a rather unique, sui generis case that you have to look at the spatial, temporal, and functional values and nature of the property before you can determine whether or not there's a taking. It's an interesting article. It's an interesting theory that I think perhaps belongs in a law review article, but really is not usable doctrine that anybody can use. I appreciate the Department of Justice, and it was Elizabeth Preliger that argued for them. Was making a very forceful argument, but whether or not that one is the one that's essentially accepted by the court remains to be seen. So to conclude, we had a very hot bench with strong arguments on all sides. When the side supporting affirmance of the decision below, there were a lot of tough questions from Justice Alito, a lot of tough questions from the Chief Justice, and more softball questions, if you will, from Breyer, Kagan, and Sotomayor, only a little bit from Ginsburg, and Kennedy's questions were a little enigmatic to read what he was really thinking, as often is the case with Justice Kennedy. There were arguments that the Palazzolo decision should be looked at by our side and should carry the day as far as what the notice issue is. And since Kennedy wrote that decision, I'm hopeful that he will understand that. But I think it's pretty much impossible to tell right now whether this is going to be a 5-3, one direction or the other, or a 4-4 argument, or whether it's the sort of argument that the chief is going to say, we should do something different here and maybe wait until we have a new Supreme Court justice either to decide or maybe to re-argue the case, depending, of course, what happens with the Gorsuch hearings this week.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.fedsoc.org/multimedia.